The Lure of the Wyrm. It was called the Wyrmberg, and it rose almost one half of a mile above the Green Valley, a mountain huge, grey, and upside down. At its base, it was a mere score of yards across. Then it rose through clinging cloud, curving gracefully outward like an upturned trumpet, until it was truncated by a plateau fully a quarter of a mile across. There was a tiny forest up there, its greenery cascading over the lip. There were buildings. There was even a small river, tumbling over the edge in a waterfall so wind-whipped that it reached the ground as rain. There were also a number of cave mouths, a few yards below the plateau. They had a crudely carved, regular look about them, so that on this crisp autumn morning the Wyrmberg hung over the clouds like a giant's dovecot. This would mean that the doves had a wingspan slightly in excess of 40 yards. "I knew it," said Rincewind. "We're in a strong magical field." Twoflower and Hrun looked around the little hollow where they had made their noonday halt. Then they looked at each other. The horses were quietly cropping the rich grass by the stream. Yellow butterflies skittered among the bushes. There was a smell of thyme and a buzzing of bees. The wild pigs on the spit sizzled gently. Hrun shrugged and went back to oiling his biceps. They gleamed.
"Looks all right to me," he said.
"Try tossing a coin," said Rincewind.
"What?"
"Go on, toss a coin."
"Okay," said Hrun, "if it gives you any pleasure."
He reached into his pouch and withdrew a handful of loose change, plundered from a dozen realms. With some care, he selected a Zaclotti, leaden quarter iotum, and balanced it on a purple thumbnail.
"You call,"
he said.
"Heads, or..."
He inspected the obverse with an air of intense concentration.
"Oh, some sort of a fish with legs."
"When it's in the air," said Rincewind. Hrun grinned and flicked his thumb. The iotum rose, spinning. "Edge," said Rincewind, without looking at it. Magic never dies, it merely fades away. Nowhere was this more evident on the wide blue expanse of the Discworld than in those areas that had been the scene of the great battles of the Mage Wars, which had happened very shortly after creation. In those days, magic in its raw state had been widely available, and had been eagerly utilized by the First Men in their war against the gods. The precise origins of the Mage Wars have been lost in the fogs of time, but disc philosophers agree that the First Men, shortly after their creation, understandably lost their temper. And great and pyrotechnic were the battles that followed. The sun wheeled across the sky, the seas boiled, weird storms ravished the land, small white pigeons mysteriously appeared in people's clothing, and the very stability of the disc, carried as it was through space on the backs of 4 giant turtle-riding elephants, was threatened. This resulted in stern action by the old High Ones, to whom even the gods themselves are answerable. The gods were banished to high places, men were recreated a good deal smaller, and much of the old wild magic was sucked out of the earth. That did not solve the problem of those places on the disc which, during the wars, had suffered a direct hit by a spell. The magic faded away, slowly over the millennia, releasing, as it decayed, myriads of sub-astral particles that severely distorted the reality around it. Rincewind, Twoflower, and Hrun stared at the coin.
"Edge it is," said Hrun. "Well, you're a wizard, so what?"
"I don't do that sort of spell."
"You mean you can't?"
Rincewind ignored this because it was true.
"Try it again," he suggested.
Hrun pulled out a fistful of coins. The first 2 landed in the usual manner, so did the 4th. The 3rd landed on its edge and balanced there. The 5th turned into a small yellow caterpillar and crawled away. The 6th, upon reaching its zenith, vanished with a sharp spang. A moment later, there was a small thunderclap.
"Hey, that one was silver," exclaimed Hrun, rising to his feet and staring upwards. "Bring it back."
"I don't know where it's gone," said Rincewind wearily. "It's probably still accelerating. The ones I tried this morning didn't come down anyway."
Hrun was still staring into the sky.
"What?"
said Twoflower. Rincewind sighed. He had been dreading this.
"We've strayed into a zone with a high magical index," he said. "Don't ask me how. Once upon a time, a really powerful magic field must have been generated here, and we're feeling the after-effects."
"Precisely,"
said a passing bush. Harun's head jerked down.
"You mean this is one of those places?" he asked. "Let's get out of here."
"Right," agreed Rincewind. "If we retrace our steps, we might make it. We can stop every mile or so and toss a coin." He stood up urgently and started stuffing things into his saddlebags.
"What?" said Two Flower.
Rincewind stopped.
"Look," he snapped, "just don't argue. Come on."
"It looks all right," said Two Flower. "Just a bit underpopulated, that's all."
"Yes," said Rincewind. "Odd, isn't it? Come on."
There was a noise high above them, like a strip of leather being slapped on a wet rock. Something glassy and indistinct passed over Rincewind's head, throwing up a cloud of ashes from the fire, and the pig carcass took off from the spit and rocketed into the sky. It banked to avoid a clump of trees, righted itself, roared around in a tight circle, and headed hubwards, leaving a trail of hot pork fat droplets.
"What are they doing now?"
asked the old man. The young woman glanced at the scrying glass.
"Heading rimwards at speed," she reported. "By the way, they've still got that box on legs."
The old man chuckled, an oddly disturbing sound in the dark and dusty crypt.
"Sapient pear wood," he said. "Remarkable. Yes, I think we will have that. Please see to it, my dear, before they go beyond your power, perhaps."
"Silence, or..."
"Or what, Liesa?"
said the old man. In this dim light, there was something odd about the way he was slumped in the stone chair.
"You killed me once already, remember?"
She snorted and stood up, tossing back her hair scornfully. It was red, flecked with gold. Erect, Liesa Wyrmbidder was entirely a magnificent sight. She was also almost naked, except for a couple of mere scraps of the lightest chainmail and riding boots of iridescent dragonhide. In one boot was thrust a riding crop, unusual in that it was as long as a spear and tipped with tiny steel barbs.
"My power will be quite sufficient," she said coldly.
The indistinct figure appeared to nod, or at least to wobble.
"As you keep assuring me," he said.
Liesa snorted and strode out of the hall. Her father did not bother to watch her go. One reason for this was, of course, that since he had been dead for 3 months, his eyes were in any case not in the best of condition. The other was that, as a wizard, even a dead wizard of the 15th grade, his optic nerves had long since become attuned to seeing into levels and dimensions far removed from common reality, and were therefore somewhat inefficient at observing the merely mundane. During his life, they had appeared to others to be eight-faceted and eerily insectile. Besides, since he was now suspended in the narrow space between the living world and the dark shadow world of death, he could survey the whole of causality itself. That was why, apart from a mild hope that this time his wretched daughter would get herself killed, he did not devote his considerable powers to learning more about the three travellers galloping desperately out of his realm. Several hundred yards away, Liesa was in a strange humour as she strode down the worn steps that led into the hollow heart of the Wyrmberg, followed by half a dozen riders. Would this be the opportunity? Perhaps here was the key to break the deadlock, the key to the throne of the Wyrmberg. It was rightfully hers, of course, but tradition said that only a man could rule the Wyrmberg. That irked Liesa. And when she was angry, the power flowed stronger, and the dragons were especially big and ugly. If she had a man, things would be different. Someone who, for preference, was a big, strapping lad, but short on brains. Someone who would do what he was told. The biggest of the three now fleeing the Dragonlands might do, and if it turned out that he wouldn't, then dragons were always hungry and needed to be fed regularly. She could see to it that they got ugly. Uglier than usual, anyway. The stairway passed through a stone arch and ended in a narrow ledge near the roof of the great cavern where the Wyrms roosted. Sunbeams from the myriad entrances around the walls criss-crossed the dusty gloom like amber rods in which a million golden insects had been preserved. Below, they revealed nothing but a thin haze. Above.
The walking rings started so close to Liesa's head that she could reach up and touch one. They stretched away in their thousands across the upturned acres of the cavern roof. It had taken a score of masons, a score of years, to hammer the pitons for all those, hanging from their work as they progressed. Yet they were as nothing compared to the 88 major rings that clustered near the apex of the dome. A further 50 had been lost in the old days, as they were swung into place by teams of sweating slaves, and there had been slaves aplenty in the first days of the power. And the great rings had gone crashing into the depths, dragging their unfortunate manipulators with them. But 88 had been installed, huge as rainbows, rusty as blood. From them... The dragons sense Liesa's presence. Air swishes around the cavern as 88 pairs of wings unfold like a complicated puzzle. Great heads with green, multifaceted eyes peer down at her. The beasts are still faintly transparent. While the men around her take their hook boots from the rack, Liesa bends her mind to the task of full visualization. Above her in the musty air, the dragons become fully visible, bronze scales dully reflecting the sunbeam shafts. Her mind throbs, but now that the power is flowing fully, she can, with barely a waver of concentration, think of other things. Now she too buckles on the hook boots and turns a graceful cartwheel to bring their hooks, with a faint clang, against a couple of the walking rings in the ceiling. Only now it is the floor. The world has changed. Now she is standing on the edge of a deep bowl or crater, floored with the little rings across which the dragon riders are already strolling with a pendulum gait. In the center of the bowl, their huge mounts wait among the herd. Far above are the distant rocks of the cavern floor, discolored by centuries of dragon droppings. Moving with the easy, gliding movement that is second nature, Liesa sets off towards her own dragon, Laolif, who turns his great, horsey head towards her. His jowls are greasy with pork fat.
"It was very enjoyable," he says in her mind.
"I thought I said there were to be no unaccompanied flights," she snaps. "I was hungry, Lietla." "Curb your hunger. Soon there will be horses to eat." "The reins stick in our teeth. Are there any warriors? We like warriors."
Liesa swings down the mounting ladder and lands with her legs locked round Laolith's leathery neck.
"The warrior is mine. There are a couple of others you can have. One appears to be a wizard of sorts," she adds by way of encouragement.
"Oh, you know how it is with wizards. Half an hour afterwards you could go with another one,"
the dragon grumbles. He spreads his wings and drops.
"They're gaining!" screamed Rincewind. He bent even lower over his horse's neck and groaned. Twoflower was trying to keep up, while at the same time craning around to look at the flying beasts.
"You don't understand!" screamed the tourist above the terrible noise of the wingbeats. "All my life I've wanted to see dragons!"
"From the inside!" shouted Rincewind. "Shut up and ride!"
He whipped at his horse with the reins and stared at the wood ahead, trying to drag it closer by sheer willpower. Under those trees they'd be safe. Under those trees no dragons could fly. He heard the clap of wings before the shadows folded around him. Instinctively, he rolled in the saddle and felt the white-hot stab of pain as something sharp scored a line across his shoulders. Behind him, Hurun screamed, but it sounded more like a bellow of rage than a cry of pain. The barbarian had vaulted down into the heather and had drawn the black sword, Kring. He flourished it as one of the dragons curved in for another low pass.
"No bloody lizard does that to me!"
he roared. Rincewind leaned over and grabbed Twoflower's reins. "Come on!" he hissed.
"But the dragons!" said Twoflower, entranced.
"Blast the—"
began the wizard and froze. Another dragon had peeled off from the circling dots overhead and was gliding towards them. Rincewind let go of Twoflower's horse, swore bitterly, and spurred his own mount towards the trees alone. He didn't look back at the sudden commotion behind him, and when a shadow passed over him, merely gibbered weakly and tried to burrow into the horse's mane. Then, instead of the searing, piercing pain he'd expected, there was a series of stinging blows as the terrified animal passed under the eaves of the wood. The wizard tried to hang on, but another low branch, stouter than the others, knocked him out of the saddle. The last thing he heard before the flashing blue lights of unconsciousness closed in was a high reptilian scream of frustration and the thrashing of talons in the treetops. When he awoke, a dragon was watching him. At least it was staring in his general direction. Rincewind groaned and tried to dig his way into the moss with his shoulder blades, then gasped as the pain hit him. Through the mists of agony and fear, he looked back at the dragon. The creature was hanging from a branch of a large dead oak tree several hundred feet away. Its bronze-gold wings were tightly wrapped around its body, but the long equine head turned this way and that at the end of a remarkably prehensile neck. It was scanning the forest. It was also semi-transparent. Although the sun glinted off its scales, Rincewind could clearly make out the outlines of the branches behind it. On one of them, a man was sitting, dwarfed by the hanging reptile. He appeared to be naked except for a pair of high boots, a tiny leather holdall in the region of his groin, and a high-crested helmet. He was swinging a short sword back and forth idly, and stared out across the treetops with the air of one carrying out a tedious and unglamorous assignment. A beetle began to crawl laboriously up Rincewind's leg. The wizard wondered how much damage a half-solid dragon could do. Would it only half kill him? He decided not to stay and find out. Moving on heels, fingertips and shoulder muscles, Rincewind wriggled sideways until foliage masked the oak and its occupants. Then he scrambled to his feet and haired off between the trees. He had no destination in mind, no provisions and no horse, but while he still had legs he could run. Ferns and brambles whipped at him, but he didn't feel them at all. When he'd put about a mile between him and the dragon, he stopped and collapsed against a tree, which then spoke to him. "Psst," it said. Dreading what he might see, Rincewind let his gaze slide upwards. It tried to fasten on innocuous bits of bark and leaf, but the scourge of curiosity forced it to leave them behind. Finally, it fixed on a black sword, thrust straight through the branch above Rincewind's head.
"Don't just stand there,"
said the sword, in a voice like the sound of a finger dragged around the rim of a large empty wine glass.
"Pull me out."
"What?" said Rincewind, his chest still heaving.
"Pull me out," repeated Kring. "It's either that or I'll be spending the next million years in a coal measure. Did I ever tell you about the time I was thrown into a lake up in the—"
"What happened to the others?" said Rincewind, still clutching the tree desperately.
"Oh, the dragon's got them, and the horses, and that box thing. Me too, except that Harun dropped me. What a stroke of luck for you."
"Well," began Rincewind. Kring ignored him.
"I expect you'll be in a hurry to rescue them," it added.
"Yes, well—"
"So if you'll just pull me out, we can be off."
Rincewind squinted up at the sword. A rescue attempt had hitherto been so far at the back of his mind that if some advanced speculations on the nature and shape of the many-dimensioned multiplexity of the universe were correct, it was right at the front. But a magic sword was a valuable item. And it would be a long trek back home, wherever that was. He scrambled up the tree and inched along the branch. Kring was buried very firmly in the wood. He gripped the pommel and heaved until the lights flashed in front of his eyes.
"Try again,"
the sword said encouragingly. Rincewind groaned and gritted his teeth.
"Could be worse," said Kring. "This could have been an anvil."
"Yagh!" hissed the wizard, fearing for the future of his groin.
"I have a multidimensional existence," said the sword.
"Hmm?"
"I have had many names, you know."
"Amazing," said Rincewind. He swayed backwards as the blade slid free. It felt strangely light. Back on the ground again, he decided to break the news.
"I really don't think the rescue is a good idea," he said. "I think we'd better head back to the city, you know, to raise a search party."
"The dragon's headed hubwards," said Kring. "However, I suggest we start with the one in the trees over there."
Sorry, but—"
"You can't leave them to their fate."
Rincewind looked surprised.
"I can't," he said.
"No, you can't. Look, I'll be frank. I've worked with better material than you, but it's either that or— Have you ever spent a million years in a coal measure?"
"Look, I—"
"So if you don't stop arguing, I'll chop your head off."
Rincewind saw his own arm snap up until the shimmering blade was humming a mere inch from his throat.
He tried to force his fingers to let go. They wouldn't. "I don't know how to be a hero," he shouted.
"I propose to teach you."
Bronze Psepha rumbled deep in his throat. Hoi Sedra, the dragon rider, leaned forward and squinted across the clearing.
"I see him," he said.
He swung himself down easily from branch to branch and landed lightly on the tussocky grass, drawing his sword. He took a long look at the approaching man, who was obviously not keen on leaving the shelter of the trees. He was armed, but the dragon rider observed with some interest the strange way in which the man held the sword in front of him at arm's length, as though embarrassed to be seen in its company. Khoi Sedra hefted his own sword and grinned expansively as the wizard shuffled towards him. Then he leapt. Later, he remembered only two things about the fight. He recalled the uncanny way in which the wizard's sword curved up and caught his own blade with a shock that jerked it out of his grip. The other thing, and it was this he averred that led to his downfall, was that the wizard was covering his eyes with one hand. Khoi Sedra jumped back to avoid another thrust and fell full length on the turf. With a snarl, Psepha unfolded his great wings and launched himself from his tree. A moment later, the wizard was standing over him, shouting, "Tell it that if it singes me, I'll let the sword go. I'll let it go, so tell it." The tip of the black sword was hovering over Khoi Sedra's throat. What was odd was that the wizard was obviously struggling with it, and it appeared to be singing to itself.
"Psepha!"
Khoi Sedra shouted. The dragon roared in defiance, but pulled out of the dive that would have removed Rincewind's head, and flapped ponderously back to the tree. "Talk!" screamed Rincewind. Khoi Sedra squinted at him up the length of the sword.
"What would you like me to say?"
he asked. "What?"
"I said, what would you like me to say?"
"Where are my friends? The barbarian and the little man is what I mean."
"I expect they have been taken back to the Wilmburg."
Rincewind tugged desperately against the surge of the sword, trying to shut his mind to Kring's bloodthirsty humming. "What's a Wilmburg?" he said.
"The Wilmburg. There is only one. It is Dragonholm."
"And I suppose you were waiting to take me there, eh?" Khoi Sedra yelped involuntarily as the tip of the sword pricked a bead of blood from his Adam's apple. "Don't want people to know you've got dragons here, eh?" snarled Rincewind. The dragon rider forgot himself enough to nod, and came within a quarter inch of cutting his own throat. Rincewind looked around desperately, and realized that this was something he really was going to have to go through with. "Right then," he said, as diffidently as he could manage. "You'd better take me to this Wilmburg of yours, hadn't you?"
"I was supposed to take you in dead,"
muttered Khoi Sedra sullenly. Rincewind looked down at him and grinned slowly. It was a wide, manic and utterly humourless rictus. It was the sort of grin that is normally accompanied by small riverside birds wandering in and out, picking up scraps out of the teeth. "Alive will do," said Rincewind. "If we're talking about anyone being dead, remember whose sword is in which hand."
"If you kill me, nothing will prevent Psepha killing you,"
shouted the prone dragon rider.
"So what I'll do is I'll chop bits off," agreed the wizard.
He tried the effect of the grin again.
"Oh, all right,"
said Khoi Sedra sulkily.
"Do you think I've got no imagination?"
He wriggled out from under the sword and waved at the dragon, which took wing again and glided in towards them. Rincewind swallowed.